everyone, I'm Laura Kunrether, and you are listening to Work, a program where Max Goldfarb and I talk to neighbors about their working lives and the relationship between work and the places we live. What are the different work trajectories that people pursue, and what kinds of work bring people to this area? Today we will hear a discussion Max and I had with Stuart, who in his own words is a Minnesota-born flannel shirt-wearing white bread farmer boy. He became a musician who toured with the Chicago blues guitarist Luther Allison 4 years after the 68 race riots in Chicago. He worked as a chef who made pizzas in a Polynesian restaurant and cooked for the diplomatic French community in Madison, Wisconsin. He was also a specialty toy maker who had a thriving 100-employee business in Red Hook until it was driven into bankruptcy by the manufacturing industry in China and the growth of Walmart. Stuart's work life began in a vegetable garden on his parents' farm with a few goats and a goat cart.
I think I was about 8 years old and I was growing my own vegetables.
And where was this?
In upstate Wisconsin. Uh-huh. And I would ride in my little goat cart with all the vegetables in the back and sell vegetables to people in the lakes. I probably had about a mile or mile and a half loop that I would do. I think it all just kind of happened by happenstance. It wasn't so much encouragement or grand idea. It was like, start growing the veggies, and I was into it, and then all of a sudden, oh, we got goats, we got a goat cart. Why don't I throw some veggies on the cart and go run around to the neighbors and see if they want some?
And was this an area that your family had been living in for a long time?
Yeah, my dad and my mom both pretty much grew up right in that area. Yeah.
So they were farming for pleasure. It wasn't a...
Yeah, just for food. Just out of... It was what they knew how to do. Mm-hmm. You know, like what everybody's doing now. Except back then it was a little less... It wasn't the same cultural context. It's just what you did. You know, right. It wasn't like, oh, let's fight against agribusiness. People didn't even know about agribusiness back then. It was like just... We're growing veggies because that's what you do.
And then you said that, you know, you got into music when you were pretty young, or did you start getting into music, and how did that fit in? Because I know that's part
of it. Well, I started with your work piano life. Lesson. My piano lesson started in, I think, third grade with Mrs. Webster. Mm-hmm. And we had a beautiful, like, 1890s Steinway upright in the house. So I was just constantly at the piano. And then the minister's wife became my piano teacher, Mrs. Webster. I hated piano lessons. I hated having to learn music. I would burst into tears, and she was very compassionate. And finally, we just gave up on the piano lessons altogether. Mm-hmm. And the instant that the piano lessons stopped, I sat down at the piano and started practicing hours a day. I got really heavily into blues music. Mm-hmm. So I was just inventing all my own patterns and studying all the blues, Fats Waller, and all the people that I could catch hold of. Hoagie Carmichael. My dad had a bunch of Hoagie Carmichael sheet music, which was like probably bought, you know, right at the time it came out, because he was into that stuff. So I was trying to learn those kinds of songs.
Was there any place where you were seeing music being played?
Not so much, no.
So how were you exposed to the blues and the...
There was a radio station in Oshkosh that had a jazz show and a blues show that I was listening to. Came across it by chance. It had Harry James, heavy duty vibrato on his trumpet. Very, very schmaltzy, but still right in the realm of actual real jazz, not, you know, total commercial stuff. And my dad a little bit exposed me. He used to play in some like local Dixieland bands and easy jazz bands. He was a trumpet player. I picked up the trumpet when I was in fourth grade, something like that. Started playing the trumpet.
And when did you start doing having music be something that you considered work for you, or a potential kind of work that you would pursue?
Sophomore year in high school, I had my own band and started booking gigs. The first band I had was Headwinds. I was trying to teach everybody else how to play music. By my junior year, the summer of my junior year is when I was in a blues band with some better players who were older than me. And then I got picked up and did the Luther Allison thing at a festival. He saw me play, and fortuitously for me, his harp player had just gotten meningitis. And he heard me play, and he came up and he said, I need a harp player. and I'm going on tour in like 2 days. Can you pull it together? And I was like, ooh, okay. So,
and where were you booking these gigs exactly?
Local places. I mean, they didn't allow us in the bars, right? So I would do different festivals. I remember there was a place for autistic children, Tomorrow's Children, Autistic Savants, and they had a series of fundraisers that they would do, I think, 3 or 4 a year. And it was pretty well attended. They would put up a big circus tent, wedding tent kind of a thing,
mm-hmm.
and do food and crafts, and then had a couple of music stages.
Uh-huh.
When I met Luther Allison, was at a larger, like a professional, and I was in the amateur tent.
Tell us a little bit about the tour.
There are no black people in northern Wisconsin at all. I had never actually talked to a black person before that. I'd seen them in a distance when I like went to the museum in Milwaukee. I think I saw a museum guard that was black, and I was kind of struck by the fact that there were black people. And I was actually kind of worried. I was aware, because I'd been reading about prejudice, and I had no idea. I had no way of knowing. I was worried that maybe I was prejudiced and I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm. And what year was it in dates?
72, 73, somewhere there. And my school wasn't utterly helpless. We did cover some of the social issues, but there were no Jews and there were no blacks up in northern Wisconsin. It's all Norwegian, German, done. That's it.
And what were your particular duties on that?
Harp player. And keep my mouth shut.
Uh-huh.
You know, they struck me as way older than me at that point. And they were like, black urban culture, and I was a white, you know, milquetoast boy from the great north in my flannel shirt kind of thing. So it was just like this culture clash. I was treated impeccably. People, because of, you know, it was Luther's boy is what they referred to me as. So, and he always had a young white harp player, I guess, was part of his show.
Was there any particular significance of that you know, in historically?
I don't know. I suppose you could... The whole thing about calling black people boy would, you know, in the reverse of it. But yeah, that was intense. A lot of different scenes. We played the Atlanta Underground when it was actually the Atlanta Underground. It hadn't been all Walt Disneyfied, which was, you know, it was dark and scary, but rich and juicy. And now it's just like scary. It's just, I went down there with my family, you know, many, many years later, and it was like, wow, they really destroyed it. You know?
And when you came back from that tour, how did that tour shape your
well, I had
ideas about the next step?
It really opened up my cultural horizons. Like, I really understood that there was a much bigger world, which I already knew, but it was like pushed right into my face.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a visceral thing for me. It made me feel, for my senior year, I was really... I mean, I participated, but there were huge chunks of my life that I couldn't share with any of my high school mates because it was just like there was no common context to have a conversation. Also, it was an exposure to master musicians. These guys had some pretty gnarly drug habits. Their lives were pretty out of control, but when they got on stage, they were unbelievably on. Just, you know, we could go 10, 12 nights in a row, and they would not drop a note. They wouldn't lose a cue, nothing. They just didn't make mistakes. And everything was, they constantly took choice chances. They were always raising the ante, trying to make it as exciting as possible, trying to drive the crowd wild, trying to drive themselves into this state of, you know, frenzy and ecstasy.
Yeah.
And that really stuck with me. It's like, at this point, if it's same music, I can kind of listen, but I'm really listening now. The things that excite me musically are when people take risks, when they go over the edge and go, well, here's my ability and there's 10% more.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it'll work out, maybe I'll fall flat on my face, and that's, to me, that's a lot more exciting. To me, it's like the essence of what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so was your aspiration to be a professional musician?
I was adamant that I was going to be a professional musician at that point. I mean, that was a real shaping experience.
Mm-hmm.
I had a prior experience playing in a polka band, but that was very brief, with Frankie Yevankovich and the Flying Dutchman. And I thought it was cool. That was actually before Luther Allison, and it was also a professional band. But very, very, very formulaic, very professional. All the guys were like in their 60s. They were all Polish. I was really, really enjoying the music. I mean, there was something about getting my abilities more and more honed that I was just really addicted to almost. It was like I loved that whole process of hearing a sound and then trying to make something out of nothing.
So did you continue then with... How did you continue with music after that tour? That was done, and did you sever your relation with Luther Allison?
Oh, that was it. I mean, the harp, in all honesty, the guy I was replacing smoked me out of the water as a harp player. I was a stand-in. I found some YouTube videos of the band, the same guys I played with, but with his normal harp player on YouTube. Oh, my God. I mean, I was pretty good. I was a hot high schooler, but this guy was like one of the, you know, he was in the upper echelon of ability. It was interesting when you played, because Luther played both with slide and with fingers, but he didn't really have a concept. He did a lot of different open tunings. Mm-hmm. Constantly had he had like three or four guitars in different tunings. And he would start a song wherever his throat felt good, because I think he smoked and he was doing, you know, all sorts of different drugs. And I think his health would go up and down. And so I had a vest and I had all 12 keys. And I got this like pitch thing where I would hear and I'd kind of look at the keyboard and I had to get a harp out and pull out the right harp, because he would just start. And the other guys just seemed to have, you know, there was this guy in a Hammond B3, and he had no problem. He could just pick up any key, and it was like the cue was right on the button. But I was like, always like reaching around in different pockets and trying to figure out just what I was going to play next. So
did you then pursue formal music training after that?
Yeah, college. It highly unsuccessful. My first year in college, I went to Coe Conservatory, and I was then touring with a Chicago bluesman named Jimmy Schwall, who taught me a lot about music, and very plugged in. His girlfriend was Bonnie Raitt for 20 years, and Vassar Clements was part of that crowd. Mm-hmm. It was this whole association of like famous and semi-famous musicians that I would either play with a little bit or sit around the kitchen table and play with, but I was like, I felt like I was part of the scene a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I would go back to school, and they were studying, especially back then, music school was dowdy. It was, you know, these rule sets. So I would go and play a gig with, you know, hundreds of screaming people with famous musicians, and then I would go back to school and study these rules from like 300 years ago. And I was just like, I just, you know. And plus, since I was still on the road while I was in college, I wasn't sleeping. I was smoking substances. So I would kind of, you know, come in at 4 or 5 in the morning back to campus. And then by 8, I had to be in music theory class. And I just kind of lay my head on the table. And I didn't like it at all.
Did you go all the way through the conservatory?
No. Well, I went, I kept going back. I think I went to 6 different schools altogether, 5, and I never graduated. I started studying physics and math and astronomy and composition and performance. I played with 5 or 6 bands, a children's theater. I was in the Central Wisconsin Orchestra. I was night, you know, I would fill in at that point in Baroque ensembles, chamber groups, just covering the board. So I stayed around Madison for a while and covered a lot of different musical styles and stuff.
And so how did your whole beginning of your life was set in the Midwest, and was that the link from Madison? You said there were a lot of New Yorkers there, to coming here?
Maybe. I think I was attracted to the culture, you know, I had a lot of like Jewish friends from Great Neck and New Rochelle that I was going to college with. Mm-hmm. And I liked the fact that they knew about Miles Davis and they knew about Mingus and they had a history and they'd grown up in a family that actually imparted that history. And it was something I had scrapped so hard to acquire, mm-hmm. against a culture where I grew up that didn't care or never, ever had heard about that stuff. Mm-hmm. I was doing... I was chefing at a restaurant, and the music theater and the symphony and going to school, and I had a girlfriend, and it's like my girlfriend left me and the symphony closed and the restaurant went out of business, and I went from like 60, 70 hours a week to zero. And I had tons of money. I was recording at that point for National Public Radio a lot and made a lot of money with them. And then I was just like, I could go anywhere. So I put a coin. I was aiming at the East Coast, but I flipped a coin and it landed on the Ashokan Reservoir. And I ended up finding a house just south of High Point Mountain, which is just south of the Ashokan, and went and rented a house for a year to do my own music research.
Uh-huh.
And at that,
so just let me, before you go into that, you were a chef for a while?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
I made pizzas at a fake Polynesian restaurant nightclub. I think it was like the Contiki Lounge or something like that, the Pow Pow Lounge, something like totally like some Wisconsin polyester version of Tahitian something. I don't know. It was like bizarre. And of course, people were coming to a Polynesian restaurant. Nobody wanted pizza, right? So they were like, I just sat in the back kitchen and I had a chromatic harp and a blues harp and my physics textbooks. And I basically sat back there and just, I'd make like a couple pizzas in a night. And teach myself how to play music and taught myself physics and stuff.
You know. And you had one other place that you said that you were a chef.
Right. My last year in Madison, I was the chef, the personal chef for the French agricultural minister and his wife and 20 agricultural students at a place called La Maison Française. And at that point, I had worked my way up to being, I would say, a mediocre cook. I was a pretty good chef. I mean, mediocre. I wasn't going to blow anyone away. But the wife of the agricultural minister's mother, who was one of the all-time great chefs of like the last century, and this woman had like, you know, so like my mediocre cooking was just, oh my God, she was. I started to really hate French people after a while because she was incredibly precise with her criticism. She was invariably right because she knew way more about cooking than I did. Sometimes we'd have these state dinners and it would be like a full 4-course, 5-course meal for like 80 people and I was the only chef. And it had to be done she. It had to be everything like perfect, mm-hmm. You know. So I could put in like a 12-hour shift and she would come back and go, oh, it's okay. And she could, you know, I would do like this flaming dessert with, you know, everything from scratch. Nothing came out of the package for that place. And she would go, pretty good, but when you beat the sugar and the butter, you should have, you know, it's like at least 50 more strokes. And, you know, I would taste it and go, well, she's right, damn it. You know, like, and I hated that. She was always right. She just knew so much more about it than I did.
Mm-hmm. So you ended up in New York. You got this place just by a flip of a coin.
Right.
And the whole point was to focus on music and,
yep.
You know.
At that point, I had really burrowed into experimental music a lot. I had been doing a lot of jazz, and I started getting into acoustics and psychoacoustics. And like I was very frustrated in college because I wanted, when I took music theory, I thought I would get down to like waveforms and the way human ears work. Like, why does something sound good and why does something sound bad? And back in those days, it was more like, well, this is the way Bach did it. Which, I mean, he was amazing. And he wrestled with those questions, so his answers are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you're not getting down to the source material. It's mm-hmm. like, how did he figure that out? I want to be able to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my New York Jewish friends from New Rochelle moved into this house south of the Ashokan Reservoir near Olive Bridge. And we studied microtones and alternate tuning systems. And we're writing music, and we took this church organ, and he was quite wealthy. So he funded all of this, and we went off through Vermont, New Hampshire, to all these old church organ places, and got tons and tons and tons of parts, and we rebuilt this church organ to do 43 notes per octave. And he still owns it. It's actually successful mm-hmm. as an instrument, based on a design by an American composer and inventor called Harry Partch.
Well, you want to say anything about Right.
Oh, just he was a curmudgeon. He was a drug addict and a crazy guy.
He built a lot of his own instruments.
Built absolutely gorgeous instruments. Invented it, the whole tuning system. Just turned the entire world of music on its ear. He owed almost nothing to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
He went back to like the roots Greek music and all sorts of alternate cultures and stands completely apart outside in music history. I don't think there's, he's like this weird deviant branch. But his whole, he produced this huge magnum opus called Genesis of the Music. And in it, he does real music theory. Just down the street from us, 15 minutes away, Carl Berger had started the Creative Music Studio. They had some sort of outside funding, and you just had to prove that you were a total monster player, and then, like, you're in. And it would be some of the most famous classical and jazz players in the world who would float in. There were no organized classes. It was like everybody would kind of mill around in this disorganized way until a foci would develop. So I was never a student there, but I came in and did several seminars on microtones and psychoacoustics and acoustics, the acoustics of instruments. I was doing a lot of experimental music, instrument building, so it was the technique of instrument building that I was teaching.
So you were making instruments also?
Yes, I did an experimental guitar with movable frets. Not a hack job. I went to a machinist and
mm-hmm.
everything was, you know, professionally done, and I had a couple of people that were looking to turn it into a commercial product at one point. I did a lot of experimental flutes, sliding head joints where the lip plate I could change. I was looking at all the different ways that you could make pitches shift on instruments.
So did working with a machinist and having the potential interest of producing these instruments start to open up ideas about production and
some. I got enthralled and enchanted by Don DuBois. He had to be in his 80s when I knew him. I met him years later at a party for a company that I'd worked for, Woodstock Percussion, and he was in his 90s, his like late 90s, and he was still in his machine shop. It was this gorgeous space. It's out down 28 west of Woodstock, out towards the Catskills more, near Boyceville. And he just brought me in. He got so into it. He was an amateur musician. He sang in the church choir. He did all these little musical inventions, so we had this in common. And we just became really good friends. And he taught me machining techniques.
Okay. I am interested in knowing the relation between, we have these toys that are sitting in front of us. What would you call this toy that's sitting in front of us?
It was on the market under the marketed name Strange Attractors. It started out, the first iteration of this was the very first ball and stick magnetic toy. So it's steel balls and rods embedded with really high power magnets to build with.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was called Rogers Connection, and we had it out, I think, for about 6 years on the market before anybody else picked up on it. And Rogers Connection got onto the QVC Shoppers Network.
This came from an interest in the tensegrity models, or?
Well, the toy company started from an interest in Buckminster Fuller. And that actually evolved out of the study of sound waves. I was very, very frustrated in the physics books. They had what I would almost call nursery school drawings. Physics got enchanted with formulas and math, and the mathematical description got really advanced. And as a consequence, the spatial relationships just were not considered important. The shape of things, the way they behaved in space, they could mathematically get there, and it was effective and it was useful, and they could get on to the next job. So, like, a good drawing, who cares? So if you see in physics books, you'll see sound waves, and it looks like a spherical form of, like, pond ripples,
uh-huh.
except, like, in spheres. And sure, like, if you're in second grade, if your artistic ability in depicting natural phenomena is nursery school level, it's accurate as far as it goes, but there's way more sophistication that you can pick up on. There's a lot more happening in the air. It's a very, very sexy, beautiful, complex movement, a waveform in the air. I was frustrated. I was working in recording studios in Woodstock. I was doing a lot of work with synthesizers, early synthesizers, tons and tons of knobs with really arbitrary names for things. And I felt like a monkey. I was just twiddling knobs and trying to figure out what would happen. There was no science to it. There was no, okay, I'm starting with a sine wave. Now, a little bit, here's a sawtooth or a square wave. But then it's like, oh, let's throw on a ring modulator. Well, what does that do? Well, it does like a ton of things. And it is a very distinctive sound. Everybody knew the sound of a ring modulated tone. It was like, it was juicy and interesting at that point. But acoustically, like 100 things just happened. So if you were interested in why it was juicy and interesting as a tone, there was no real answer. We threw some circuits together and it's doing a whole bunch of crap. And at the end, it's this wonderful sound that everybody's very entranced with. And it was marketable, so it got on there. And you had a dial ring modulator and you could dial it and it would like do these weird things with the tone. And I'm like, well, why though? Mm-hmm. Bucky Fuller was one of the few people that was dealing with natural phenomena and dealing with shape. Bucky developed tensegrity from the work of one of his students, a fairly famous sculptor named Kenneth Snelson, who's still quite active. And if you go down to Storm King,
yes,
when you come up the main drive, right there in the front of Storm King is a Kenneth Snelson, and it's absolutely gorgeous. These huge, suspended in the air, like aluminum tubes that are 20, 30 feet long, and the improbable suspensions, none of them touching, all in a network of tension. And Bucky took that and regularized it. He started to mathematically analyze what was going on and put it in his books. And I came across it and had an argument with my wife at the time, Carrie, about some of the diagrams. And she built a little model. She built the first one. We got so fascinated with the shapes themselves, we started to build them and build lots of them. And they grew like little children around the house. And we kept on doing all the different variations with soda straws and popsicle sticks and anything that we could find. And then at one point, I went down to the workshop at Bard and I had bought tons of dowel. And I made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of like exactly the same length dowel with little. And it was like the first, we didn't know it, but it was like the first iterations of what would be the toy. It evolved. The Tensegratoy was the very first product. What happened, Carrie was a massage therapist. She had a lot of entrepreneurial, very wealthy entrepreneurs that were coming for massages, and they saw these things around the house. Mm-hmm. And this was a time, this was the early 80s, when Nature Company and Smith and Erewhon and Erewhon Natural Foods, Smith and Hawken, I'm trying to think of, Natural Wonders, there were all of these like ex-hippies who were trying to do green capitalism, and there was this resurgence of like kind of cool products that were hitting the market and a fairly organized delivery system in the culture to get those products out to people. And all of the 60s hippies were now becoming, the baby boomers were getting to the age where they had free money and they had kids. And so I kind of rode that wave. And they all said, you should make this into a project, you'd get rich. And we're like, oh, okay. I had no idea how to do business. I had no idea how to do production, really. Mm-hmm. So we started out of the house with the drill press, and I was making them by hand. And we went to the very, very first show. We got in an industrial design award to get into a part of the New York Gift Show, which at that point was very, very hard to get into, called Axonon Design. And we were the only toy company, and we were mobbed. We had one product. We had made an entire booth that looked like the Apollo lunar landing module. It was kind of a mock-up of that, all made out of the toy. And big. It was, 10 feet high and 10 feet across, filled up an entire booth space. Mm-hmm. And we were just mobbed with people. Everybody went crazy for it. And at the very end, the original owners of F.E.O. Schwartz came up and said, can you do our front window? Now, at that point, the day before the show, we had just gotten married. The day the show started, I'd actually gotten my incorporation papers. And it was my 30th birthday. And so I was like, sure. I mean, at that point, F.A.O. Schwartz had the premier window on Fifth Avenue for the whole Christmas window thing. They were the, you know, you'd go up and down Fifth, and F.A.O. was the highlight. So it was a big, big deal. So instead of going on our honeymoon, we went the day after the show and climbed into the window at F.A.O. and figured out how to make something cool.
So what was the model that you built when you had that opportunity?
We did a 14-foot diameter Saturn. So the ring, Saturn's rings were 14 feet wide, and it was like on a the motorized table thing so that it rotated slowly. And then on a larger motorized ring, we built geometric representations, but they were pretty clear. They were comets and shooting stars and stuff. And then they surrounded the entire background with pushpin lights that were computerized to twink.
Yeah.
So that got us on the cover of all of the toy magazines and the trade journals, you know. Oh my God. And
so then you had sort of an overnight, like,
overnight
order,
success
orders,
thing. Yeah.
What did
huge
that mean?
Orders. Well, it meant from F.A.O. Schwartz, we were featured everywhere in the press, and everybody came to F.A.O. Schwartz to get them because, of course, the way F.A.O. wanted it, they were pretty much, they dominated our production.
How was your production happening at that point?
It was me on a drill press.
It was you
at
were,
home?
Yeah.
You were manufacturing.
And eventually, well, at that point, we started hiring people, and I went back to Mr. Du Bois, Don Du Bois, the old machinist, and said, Don, I've got to be able to drill these holes. We have this special system so that people could do these things with the cords without doing knots. We did it in elastic, so it was like an easier version. Because to do a normal tensegrity, you have to, like, get out your calculator and do trig. You got to get the string lengths like perfect. So we got a super high grade elastic, figured out we got an old shoelace tipping machine to tip the elastic with brass, and you'd loop it around the end of the stick and put it in this hole, and there were different holes in the stick so you could adjust the tension for different shapes. But you didn't have to tie knots and you didn't have to calculate lengths. So we kind of basically took something really technical and dumbed it down to where you could actually build with it. And dumbed down for that was still way, way, way more complex than most toys. Most women did well because women would read the instructions. We eventually did a comic book version of the instructions on the front page, and it had a headline like, if you hate reading instructions, just at least look at these five pictures. Because all of the guys would like look at this 60-page manual and go, oh crap, I can just figure it out. And of course, they couldn't. It was unlike anything they'd ever built. And they'd go, oh, this thing doesn't work at all. And, you know, so in order to get people past the hump where they learned how to build.
So what age were you marketing to? This was such
like
a difficult...
Like 10 and up. But at the same point, that tensegrity, that first product, was used by scientists all over the world in real science experiments. So in cancer cell research... the biopathy of cancer tumors, it was used. It was used in a lot of things. In microcell research, they were trying to work out the internal structure of the human cells.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out there's like a skeletal structure inside of a human cell. It's not, I was taught it was like a big bag of jelly, kind of, with a bunch of stuff floating around. Well, it turns out there's rigid members, just like a tensegrity.
Mm.
And the cell membrane becomes like the cords. That's the tensile part of it.
So once you started having a major production need,
mm-hmm.
obviously you couldn't do that by yourself.
No. Well, we started to hire local people, friends. I got more drill presses. We started to work it out. At that point, I got hired by a friend of mine, amazing guy, Gary Kivistat, who owns Woodstock Percussion. He's a world-class percussionist, really amazing player. He had a wind chime company that really was going through the roof. And he approached me because he knew I knew about mechanical stuff. He had just done an NPR interview and he had like thousands of orders that he couldn't produce. And he's like, can you figure out a way to automate this? And I was like, sure. I had no idea. But, you know, that's kind of what I answer everything with. And I found this young genius guy, Mark Bernard, who was a computer programmer. We tried to shop it out to like normal engineering companies, and they wanted like $250,000 for a feasibility study. And so I thought, this is ridiculous. So I called up the head of mechanical engineering at MIT, Ernesto Blanco, and the professors at MIT got together and designed Gary's first production machine. From that point on, we eventually developed 45 different products altogether, both designed by my then wife Carrie and myself, and also from outside designers. And I developed and designed all the production machinery for that stuff. We were starting to compete with China, was the driving. China was just starting to come in and take over, like the production quality from China was no longer a joke.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be just so bad. But they built their infrastructure up. They got the machine tooling. They were really organized, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The efficiency of a dictatorship, I guess. So they were coming at us, and we didn't. I was totally uninterested in Chinese production. So what I started to do was analyze every aspect of the production of our products, and I'd find the most expensive part, the most expensive process, the most, which was always human labor, and then I would design a machine to do it. So I started to do more and more production machinery. I think I did maybe a dozen machines altogether.
So how many people were at one point working for your company, and how did that shift as you developed more and more of these machines?
It was a roller coaster. It went up and down. At our peak, we had over 100 people, not all on location. We actually were the first company to do get an industrial homework permit in New York State. They hadn't written one since the law was created in the 1940s. The law was pretty much, you know, they called it the homework permit law, but actually it was there to limit competition for the New York companies like Kodak,
mm-hmm,
and General Electric, those that started in New York, and they'd just gotten up to the point where they could affect the New York State Legislature and created a set of laws in New York that would tamp down the local competition. So we had people working at home, and at the point illegally, but we didn't know it. We'd never heard of the homework permit law. And technically what they were doing was industrial work. But then we mounted this whole political thing and got the permit done. And that was kind of quite a good thing. A lot of local politicians in this area really pulled together and pulled strings, because we were employing a lot of people. We had 110 people employed. So
uh-huh,
we were Red Hook based. So Northern Dutchess, Southern Columbia.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was people who, disabled people, elderly people, single moms that couldn't, you know, that wanted to work. And it was this, we had, when we really grew up, we had a lot of little handwork pieces that were easy. You could sit and watch TV and watch the kids and do this little handwork and get certain assemblies done and just bring a bag of them back and get your money. And it was fantastic and it was really successful.
How did they get this work? How did they find out?
Word of mouth. Oh my God. If you have a blue collar facility, I mean, I was just talking about a guy who's doing some factory work in Socrates and was lamenting that they yelled at him. And it's like, if you went to the bathroom, you could only be 2 minutes in the bathroom, and they had a time clock and they did 12 hour shifts. And,
mm-hmm,
you know, it's like kind of a brutal environment. And we had like a family scene. We didn't hire anybody unless all of the workers approved the new person. Like, they would spit out a bad seed, gone. They're gone. Because everybody there, we weren't the highest paying employer, but the workspace was incredibly humane. And we really worked at making it people comfortable and giving them personal responsibility. And they knew, like, their stuff was going into Museum of Modern Art and, you know, really high-end places. So, like, people had some pride in what they were doing. And they were, it's interesting, it got to be really, really protective of the quality of the workspace. I didn't have to police that, the workers would. It became self-leading.
Did you ever disagree with them? Were there ever
moments
where
I was a pretty crappy employer. I mean, I'm not a manager. I'm not a person. I was really focused on the design. I was really focused on, I was going to tons of science conferences because most of our designers were mathematicians and scientists from around the world, and I was very hooked into that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Hanging out with those guys, I was like the entertaining guy that, you know, didn't affect their standing in the science world. They could all have fun with me and loosen up because I wasn't trying to write the paper that they were trying. I don't know what it was, but whatever. I knew enough to understand a lot of what they were going after. I couldn't do what they were doing, but they knew that I actually understood the crux of the issues they were going after, and I was fun to hang out, drink beers with, and go out to dinner. So I'd hit these conferences, and they would pull me aside and go, there's this process in nature and it looks like this and it's amazing and you have to find a way to get this out so people understand. Uh-huh. So I would take something as abstract as that and then work with it until I would get, you know, we had a set of building blocks in the shape of a carbon atom. So 3 and 4 year olds could build and they would just be working with the shape of carbon. It's a kinesthetic lesson. It's about point of balance and sharp edges and dull edges, and they just happen to be dealing with like the primary form of all organic chemistry, but they don't need to know that.
Right.
All they need to know is that it gets into their fingers and gets into their bodies. And I've had a lot of feedback still from people who had those toys when they were young and said, oh my God, you know, it had a huge impact. Now I know what all those equations were describing because it's all shapes. Everything has got a shape. The one that I have with us on the table here, I built a cube. This is a magnetic building toy, and there's 12 different strut lengths,
mm-hmm.
and they're all 12 different colors. They're in 4 different color groups.
Mm-hmm.
The color groups all have a length relation within each color group of what's called the golden ratio. And this is analogous to studying scales and arpeggios in music. This is what you do when you study geometry. It's learning the way that all the shapes interrelate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's primarily hidden in our education system. The cubic-based approach that we have abstracts all of the other shapes into irrational relationships. Actually, if you start with the tetrahedron, all of the different relationships between the shapes show up in whole numbers. And it's inherently logical and simple. So this is an example of a toy where all you're doing is building. And we provide the information about what the significance of the different lengths are, because those lengths are the 12 lengths that basically allow you to make most of the geometry that shows up in nature. All you have to do is play.
Mm-hmm.
And between high eye-hand coordination and spatial exploration, if you just open it up to an open-ended sense of play, the geometry lesson is inherently embedded in the structure of the toy.
Right, like mine just collapsed.
So you don't, right, exactly, why? And every child is going to build a cube to start with, because that's what we're familiar with. And because the magnetic joints are flexible, the cube is going to fall over.
Mm-hmm.
And so right away, a kid, maybe not exactly consciously, but is going to say, why? And then they're going to experiment and go, oh, look, a red strut exactly fits in the diagonal of that blue square.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's triangulated and it's stable.
Tell us, just let's go back to that transformation that you talked about from, you know, basically a 110-person company to making the machinery that would do the same thing that those
right.
110 people were doing.
Well, yeah, it would take over some. There was still plenty of employment. I was trying to find a way to keep the production local, because the idea, almost all of the toy companies in the United States, and I think when I went into business, I can't remember the exact number, but it was 4,000 some odd toy companies, actual manufacturers in the U.S., in like 1982 or 83 when I started out. And we're down to, I don't know if there's any more than 5 or 6 now, if there's any at all. I haven't looked at the data lately, but I know when I left, when my company folded in 2005, we were down to like a dozen. And a lot of them I knew were in trouble. And it was because of all of production moving to China. I was struggling against that tide, and it was ultimately a losing battle, because the tide of production moving to China didn't just change where the workforce lived. It changed the way products were designed, and it changed the way how products were marketed in the United States. So once you had a design team in the U.S. that was taking trips over to China to do production that was largely out of your control in a country that's part dictatorship and part Wild West, where things are wildly copied and things, you know, there's just, it's like if you chanced into the right situation, it was okay. But still, like I had runs of products. I would design for a year and a half and build machinery and do a run of products that I would sell 1,000 of in a year. They were expensive, but I lost fantastic amounts of money but not nearly as much. If I had gone to China, now I'd be looking at 100,000 or 200,000 of that product. So the kinds of chances that manufacturers would take and the kinds of products they would design all of a sudden went in mass, because that's the way China was set up. Really cheap labor. They do the machining. They would do all of the molds for free. I mean, they were just giving away the store in order to get all the business. And they were really successful at it. And that, in combination with the growth of like Walmart and Target and the big chain stores, created the collapse of the entire specialty toy industry. So Nature Company, Natural Wonders, Noodle Cadoodle, World of Science, Zany Brainy, Learning Smith, Store of Knowledge, all of these were chain stores. For the most part, that entire group, explicitly like Nature Company, were like enlightened hippie capitalists that were trying to go into capitalism and make it greener and make it more gentle and make it more humane. And it was an experiment. Ben and Jerry's is a good example. Mm-hmm. By and large, they all grew up, either got bought out, like Nature Company got bought out by Discovery Channel, Ben and Jerry's got bought out by some person. And by and large, what started out as an amazing real human experiment in capitalism turned into a brand. It got that kind of crunchy granola feel to it. Everybody got friendly with it. It got that warm, fuzzy feeling that American consumers want. And they're like, great, ship out the production. Let's go mass. Now we have our brand. And they market it as a brand. And China was part of that. So ultimately, I lost. That was a battle that was way too big to win. And my company folded. I went from my very best year in 2004, a brand new factory that I'd built, and tons of employees and best sales and best profits. And the very next year, I was completely bankrupt. So catastrophic. Every single one of my 14 out of my 15 biggest accounts went bankrupt. Several thousand of the stores in my account list went under, most of them with the toys that I produced in stock and unpaid for.
How many people were working for you who also were going under with you? And
well, the employee count had gone down because there was a couple of products that really drove up this work at home employee thing, because I had a nice modern factory, but not big enough for 110 people on a shift. And that toy had its, all toys have their craze and goes up and down, and you're trying to plan against these fads that people have. I'm going to guess we had about 40 employees, 50, something like that at the height that were showing up, that were coming to work.
Were you seeing other facilities taking advantage of the work at home method?
To my knowledge, we were the only work at home permit ever approved in New York State. There might be others, but I know we were the first. The law basically was pretending to create a permit for work at home, and it was designed to prevent working at home. Its entire purpose was to shut that down. Mm-hmm. And
when you had the factory, were you also having people work at home?
Yes.
Came into
yes.
the factory
after Yeah, well, especially at the beginning of this toy craze, we had a little tiny building, and we were alternating shifts and overlapping shifts and crazy. I mean, I was just a sleep deprivation experiment at that point. Mm-hmm. Walmart, Target came in. I don't even think they were aware of it. They just put a line of specialty toys. I don't think they had some like evil scheme or anything. I don't even know if they noticed that the specialty toy industry existed, because from their perspective, it's so small. We were like a pimple on the butt of commerce. It was just tiny. And they just kind of did an offhand gesture. They changed a planogram. They put in a bunch of Chinese toys, and they said, the sign on top said specialty toys. And that was enough. The shift happened, and that in conjunction with the movement of production to China and the whole, like the culture moved into mass. Mm-hmm. All of that artisan culture thing just was no longer, just everything evaporated at once. Mm-hmm.
So where were you in 2005 then?
I was really depressed. I was really, 20 years I'd done building this up. I felt really vibrant and alive as a part of the culture. I was connected with some of the top scientists in the world. I was getting I had a museum that did a show exclusively of our toys, curated our toys as the show in Buenos Aires. another place in Europe. I mean, we were in the Design Collection Museum of Modern Art, and I was working really, really hard. I was swimming upstream as hard as I could against the culture, and in some instances, contrary motion is a pretty healthy thing. But then if it's a flood, you know, when China and Walmart and Target and the whole movement of the culture moves against you, at some point it just becomes futile. And I was just washed away.
So at that point, there's a point just before this really took off where you had also been going pretty deep with your music theory and experimentation, and then your path kind of diverged from
right.
that. So in 2005, did you kind of reconnect?
Well, actually, no. I had gotten really intensely into the microtones and the experimental music, which had almost no commercial potential. And I was really involved in the studios, which was aesthetically pretty, it was economically viable, but it was aesthetically not very rewarding. And when I settled down into a serious relationship, I was clear, at least some subconscious part of my brain knew that I wanted to have a family. And when I looked at the musicians who were 10 years or 15 years older than me, they either had a family and they metered down on the music, or they had a drug habit and a wild lifestyle where they were on the road 300 days a year. And I think there was some primeval part of my brain that was enough aware that I had to make a choice, and I really backed out of music and moved into having a family. That's when the toy company started up. That's when all that time freed up and I was no longer doing the music. Then when my sons got older, they got old enough, and I started to teach them music, and there started to be like the coffee houses at the school, because I was really torn about leaving music. It was very difficult. I couldn't go to a performance. If the performance was good, I was intensely jealous of the fact that they had that opportunity and I no longer did. And if the performance was bad, I was just like, I have to, you know. So there was no way for me to win. I was just too torn up about it. It was too emotionally, you know,
or for them
tough
to
for
win.
Me. Huh?
Or for them to win.
Yeah. No. Can't win for losing for that.
What did you end up doing after 2005?
Well, I had these programming skills. Mm-hmm. And I started first gently, because I needed another profession now. Mm-hmm. I started to do first on a smaller scale and larger networks. And
uh-huh.
picking up jobs with some of the people who were my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And working alongside of them, so I got experience. But now I'm more focused in the Camp Hill community about building things from scratch. There's a Camp Hill out in Copake, another one in Ghent. And so I'm participating in designing the networks for them. And designing all the networking for them, and it's a lot of fun. They're great people.
Can you, as we sort of step, you've had a lot of different things you've done. Is there any thread that you see that runs through these different
arrogance? I have an innate confidence in my own skills. I've just been utterly confident that, you know, okay, here's a field. I'll just learn what it is and go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never even had the thought of, you know, will I be good enough? I think I never actually thought of any of them as a career. It was just something I found interesting and I wanted to do it, and I had the desire, so I stayed present with that desire. I stayed present
mm-hmm.
with the excitement of the learning, and it just goes where it goes. And I think it's a leap of faith that it would
mm-hmm.
always, you know, sometimes it didn't pay me that well.
But
know.
There did always seem to be an entrepreneurial relationship to what you were finding.
Right, right, because that basic attitude doesn't work well in a corporate environment. I don't think, you know, I'm looking at it from the outside because I've never been in a corporate environment, but in my experience in my life, if you're thinking independently and you're really just focused at the job at hand, you're not going to do well in a corporation.
Were there ever moments, I mean, in some ways the narrative that you're telling is sort of you know, the self-made man,
mm-hmm.
the one who thinks independently, the sort of American dream of, you know,
the
kind
half-made
of person, which, you know, people have said are
right.
is kind of a myth in a way, even though we still have it and appeal to it.
Mm-hmm.
So were there any moments during the course of your working life where you just questioned
oh yeah I mean when
the
toy company went down, oh my goodness, when you spend the middle part of your life building something, a structure that takes 20 years to build, and it gets to where you have employees and you're part of a culture and that all of that is in place, and then bang, it's gone. Boy, yeah, I had a lot of doubts at that point. Where, you know, I've spent quite a few years kind of milling about where it's, where's my new place in culture? I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. Now I'm entering back into the music world and it's all changed. The live club scene, while it's active in Hudson, we're a little island in a pretty much sea of mediocrity that's happening in club scenes in general. And where, I mean, in the 70s and in the 80s, I could play five nights a week. All the music labels are, you know, they're dead. They don't know it yet, but they're dead. Mm-hmm. And the entire scene in music has changed, and no one really knows what the economic model is, really.
How do you talk about that with your son, who's a musician and who's finishing school?
I could talk till I was blue in the face. I think when you're like, you know, 18 to 24 or whatever, and you're so excited by the power of music, you know, all the practical knowledge, and it doesn't matter. They're just going to take their shot. They're going to follow their juice, and I can't blame them for that. Mm-hmm. So I guess they have the same innate trust in their own talents and their ability to make a way somehow in the world.
So before we finish our conversation, would you be willing to improvise a little bit with the flute?
This is a song that recurs back for me all the time. It's Eric Dolphy. It's called So Glad to Be Unhappy. And this, I don't know, it's become almost a theme for me.
Stewart's story of work traverses the country, from his parents' so-called gentleman's farm in Wisconsin, to Atlanta, where he performed as Luther's boy on the blues harp, to the Hudson Valley area, after a flip of a coin, where he studied the work of Buckminster Fuller, the well-known engineer, designer, and futurist. Fuller's model, the tensegrity, became Stewart's model for designing toys. As Stewart tells his story, we are reminded of the entrepreneurial spirit that underlies that great myth of the American dream. While someone of Stewart's temperament and social position can realize this dream at times, there's always Walmart or companies like it lurking in the background to contend with.
Work is a program produced by Max Goldfarb and Laura Kunreuther for WGXC Community Radio 90.7 FM. You can listen to episodes of this program by visiting the program archive at wgxc.org.